Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. He's the $1 million intern, high school basketball phenom Darius Bazley. He decommitted from Syracuse and signed a huge deal with New Balance to train for a year before the NBA draft. He's foregoing that one-and-done season in college basketball. Here's his agent, Rich Paul, who also represents LeBron James.
I'm not going to sit here and say, hey, everyone should follow this path. This was just the right path for Darius Bazley and his family.
But it could be part of a growing trend, athletes taking ownership and agency over their futures on the field and the court. College football players, for example, refusing to play in bowl games. The NFL's Le'Veon Bell sitting out a year during his prime. The WNBA Players Union opting out of a collective bargaining agreement over concerns about revenue sharing, pay equity, and transparency. So this hour on Point, athletes take on exploitation, amateurism, and perhaps putting self-preservation first. And you can join us. Are these athletes right to take charge when their livelihoods and health are on the line? Should owners and management push back? Do you buy the idea that these athletes are even being exploited? Has the multi-billion dollar sports industry gotten out of control? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from Washington is Kevin Blackstone, ESPN panelist and professor of sports journalism at Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland. He also writes sports commentary for The Washington Post. Kevin Blackstone, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
So you were definitely the inspiration for this hour, I have to say, because at the tail end of last year, we caught your sort of prediction for 2019 that you wrote in The Washington Post. And I have to say, most of the time, I'm kind of like, yeah, I'm not sure how much stock to put into predictions, especially in this day and age. But you wrote this very provocative couple of paragraphs where you say that could there be a rise in the number of athletes or associations that are pushing back against being exploited by leagues and teams? What do you mean?
Well, I just think that collectively, athletic talent is starting to understand their own agency and their own power. And the amazing thing is that that's always been the case with the professional ranks. And it slowly has become the case with college athletes. But now you start to see it drifting down to high school athletes. And one of the reasons, of course, for all of this is the amount of money that is involved in all these sports. And when you think about high schools, you say, well, there's not much money in high schools. But in fact, over the past few years, there's been more and more as shoe companies like Under Armour and Nike have invested in high school sports, as high school sports leagues have cut contract deals to be televised on places like ESPN. And then as those athletes have been shopped around to colleges for more and more money, you kind of understand how people start to take a step back and understand their role as cogs in this college athletic industrial complex.
Right.
And so I think because of that, and because of what the examples that have been set by some others in previous years, I just see this becoming more and more of a conflict, right? More and more of a struggle as these athletes start to coalesce and fight for what they believe is theirs against ownership and management.
Right. So you mentioned high school athletes, and we played that little bit of tape from Darius Bazley's agent just a second ago. I want to hear more about Bazley's story. So in October, Bazley's agent, Rich Paul, told ESPN that Darius was going to forego college and instead take a $1 million internship. I mean, you were talking about shoe companies before. He's taking this $1 million internship with New Balance. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
We're talking about a system here that's been broken for a long time. And these kids and the families need options. And for me, I come from the athlete side, where I'm always trying to find out how do I do what's best for the athlete, not necessarily for me per se. And so, you know, the comments are, you know, again, he's part of a system. He's part of a system that they've been able to control for a long time.
That's Rich Paul, Darius Baisley's agent. First of all, tell us, Kevin, tell us more about Darius himself. Who is he? And he obviously, he's a basketball phenom.
Right. He's a he's one of a number of high school aged basketball phenoms in this country who was being recruited by all manner of colleges in the country. He was the number 13 prospect on ESPN's 2018 recruiting list. He had originally said that he was going to play for Coach Jim Boeheim at Syracuse. And then he said in March that he was going to instead play for the NBA's minor league system known as the G League. And the G League recently announced that it was going to increase its salary for its most marketable talent, like maybe a Beasley, to $125,000. And then a little bit later, he came out with Paul, who happens to be LeBron James's agent, and said that they were working on this new deal where he would actually be an intern for New Balance, train for a year, and then declare for the NBA draft in 2019. And remember, there is a rule a collusion between colleges and the NBA, which says that a player has to be of a certain age mm-hmm. or have to have done at least a year in college before he can come to the right. NBA. And so this was a way of getting around this. And basically, Paul guaranteed him with New Balance a salary far greater than what the G League would have paid him, certainly more than the room, board, and tuition and books fees that a college would have paid for him to hone his skills as a basketball player and hopefully cash in with a professional contract.
So let me ask you, though. I mean, I can see why Baisley's saying, I'm not going to do the NCAA's one-and-done system because he knows right. he's going to go to the NBA, as you're saying. And so why spend a year in college not making any money but perhaps helping Syracuse make a ton of money? But So he's making $1 million now in this quote-unquote internship with New Balance. Right. But certainly New Balance is getting something out of it.
Sure. They're getting publicity. They're getting a player who, if he pans out to be great, will be a face for its business in the NBA. They are also doing this above board because right now we have in this country several trials, one that's already taken place, a couple more that are about to come up, which have charged shoe representatives for these basketball shoe companies like Nike and Adidas with federal crimes for basically for bribing families and high school players and maybe even coaches to deliver their sons to certain schools. But here, New Balance is doing this above board. Mm-hmm. They're saying we're going to deliver this kid to whatever team drafts him in the NBA and not even to a college. So, this is and this player is basically saying in his family, great, this is a better opportunity for us. This is a better situation for us. They're going ahead with it full steam.
But, you know, Kevin, I got to ask you, I mean, obviously Darius Baisley is a star, right? And mm-hmm. he's kind of a part of an extraordinary handful of high school athletes
sure.
here. And yet in your Washington Post sort of look ahead to 2019, you wrote that as more and more athletes in the pros, college, and even high school basically are taking their balls and going home rather than accepting exploitation in the multi-billion dollar sports and industrial complex. And you say that this is a trend that could prove even more disruptive and important in 2019. I mean, really? Because, I mean, the Darius Baisleys of the world aside, where else are you seeing this that makes you think that this
sure.
is a
well,
trend?
This is right. Well, he's one of just a few. But I do think that this will start to become a trend if it works out for him. I do think that there are more and more people who look at the college system, the high school to college system, as being somewhat fraudulent, given all the money that these kids, primarily black male kids, make for these colleges and universities, for their coaches, for their athletic directors, for their conference commissioners, and that they want a better share, a more equitable share of that economy. And then not only that, but when you start to look back down the pipeline, they're also delivering a lot to the high schools for which they participate. It's interesting that Paul represents LeBron James and is doing this because LeBron James could have gone down or did go down this same path, could have gone down a similar path when he was in high school. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated as a junior in high school. His games became so popular in Akron that St. Vincent's, the college that he played at, moved the home games to the University of Akron, where they started packing a college gymnasium to watch LeBron James play. Those ticket sales, of course, went back to St. Vincent's. So they were profiting madly off of LeBron James as a teenager. And a lot more schools are doing the exact same thing. A lot more athletic apparel companies are investing in high schools. And so that's why I think you're going to see a lot more of this.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we come back from the break, we'll talk about how we're seeing maybe analogous decisions made by pro athletes in the NFL and the WNBA as well. I'm speaking with Kevin Blackstone. He is an ESPN panelist and professor of sports journalism at the University of Maryland. He writes sports commentary for the Washington Post, and he's presented us with this interesting idea, this interesting thesis, that we'll see more and more athletes take agency over their own lives and their own careers, you know, shirking, for example, requirements of the NCAA or even the control that teams or leagues may have over them. He calls it a potentially disruptive trend in sport. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about athletes and perhaps more of them taking agency over their own value in the context of the leagues that they play in, and whether or not this could be a disruptive trend in sports. Kevin Blackstone, who's an ESPN panelist and professor of sports journalism at the University of Maryland, has written about this, and he says it could be disruptive. He's with us from Washington. And before the break, Kevin and I were talking about high school sports and how we've got a handful of very talented high school players, such as Darius Baisley, who are going their own way rather than playing for a year in the NCAA and then going to the NBA. So let's look over to the WNBA now, because the WNBA Players Union has opted out of its collective bargaining agreement because of over revenue sharing, pay equity, and transparency issues. So, for example, let's listen to Los Angeles Sparks star and WNBA Players Association president Nneka Egumike. She appeared on ESPN in November to talk about why they're opting out of their contract with the NBA.
For us, it's about the overall player experience. The game isn't the game without us. And foundationally, I think we can work together with the league to create some infrastructural changes that will really enhance both the player experience and the game.
Well, joining us now is Terry Jackson. She's with us from New York. She's executive director of the WNBA Players Association, former director of law, policy, and governance with the NCAA as well. Terry Jackson, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, can you just explain to us, for folks who don't know the intricacies of the contracting agreement between the WNBA and the NBA here, what did the Players Association have an issue with?
Well, first of all, the collective bargaining agreement that the Players Association has is with the WNBA.
Okay.
So it's a CBA between the WNBA, the league, and the WNBPA, the Players Association, the union that represents the players. And so there are a number of issues that are of concern to the players. I would say just generally it's all on the table. Won't really get into specifics, but for those who know this league, for those who are fans of the game, fans of these players, we know that you've been paying attention. We know that you've heard the players talk about what we've talked about in our meetings with the players and how they have come to understand the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement. It's about salary and compensation opportunities. It's about opportunities to improve the player experience. It's about opportunities to address and ensure up player health and wellness and safety concerns. Like I said, it's all on the table.
Okay. So Kevin Blackstone, jump in here. And for those of us who aren't as familiar with the story as perhaps we should be, I mean, you've written, for example, the pay equity issue. I mean, tell us more about what the WNBA Players Association is trying to accomplish here.
Well, I think like a lot of other professional women's leagues, they too, as I use this phrase, want a more equitable deal with ownership and management. And so for WNBA players who make, and Terry can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think somewhere around on average something like $70,000 a year for the season. Some players make considerably more for a variety of reasons, primarily because they are stars and faces of the league. And then they often supplement their salary by playing professionally overseas or by doing some other jobs here in this country, maybe in journalism as broadcasters. And so there's a they play in a different world,
mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that they play under the same umbrella as the NBA. Which obviously pulls in just a ton of money and, I must say, makes it possible for the WNBA to exist. But last year there was a remarkable incident where the Las Vegas Aces refused to play a game after arriving here in Washington. And the reason they refused to play was because basically it took them like a day to get from an airport in Las Vegas here because of myriad problems with connecting flights and weather and all of that.
Yeah.
And yet they were expected to play, and they refused to play because they said physically they were not ready to play. And if they did play in the physical shape that they were in, they risked injury. And for a WNBA player to risk that sort of injury also would mean that she could not play overseas and pick up the additional money that she has mm-hmm. to work for. So these are the kinds of problems that the WNBA needs to work out.
Right. So Terry Jackson, tell us more about that. I mean, is what the Las Vegas Aces did, is it sort of emblematic of the concerns that players have?
Sure, it is. It's definitely one example, and it's an important one. And I'm happy that I'm sharing this time with Kevin, because he shed such great light on this story last year and really gave it attention. I mean, the players were speaking out, and they were on their social and sharing what was happening with them. I mean, every kind of delay possible in terms of weather, equipment, missing the connection. I mean, it just kept mounting up. And you're right. I mean, this to them was squarely in that category. We talk about player health and wellness and safety concerns. They had real concerns. I believe their members of their organization, their training staff, also had some serious concerns with their ability to play and to give the fans the best performance that they could give. And they were in the playoff hunt at the time. So that was a real critical game for them at a real critical time. And at some point, they just had to step back and say, wait a second, this is not right. This has happened before, a season or two before, with an Indiana team, a similar situation with travel. We have to put a spotlight on this issue. We have to advocate and stand up and protect ourselves on this one, kind of take one for the team, literally, right? Mm-hmm. Take one for the entire organization, put the spotlight on it, and be sure this is one of the issues that we get our arms yeah. around. And you know, I think the league understands it too.
Right.
And opting out on November 1 gives that opportunity to put everything on the table and have a good discussion.
Okay. Terry, can I ask you another question about revenue sharing here? Because if I understand correctly, and again, please, I don't understand the intricacies of the contract process at the WNBA as much as I should, so correct me if I'm wrong. But for example, with the NBA, players get what, 50% of the revenue? The revenue generated at the WNBA, it's closer to 20%. Do I have that right?
Well, you know, let me say this, Magna. I'm very appreciative of the interest and what the attention a lot of the writers have put on this issue. It's for us, it's not the only one.
Uh-huh.
It's an important one, but it's not the only one, right? And so they've given that attention, they've done the research and they've done their calculations on what, you know, is publicly available. We are privy to and have available, you know, a little bit more information. Our document information exchange with the league has been a very productive one. So I'm not going to really, you know, get down into the specifics and nail down and the percentages on that. I would just say it's one of the issues that we've highlighted, and it's one of the things that we're going to examine and look at in collective bargaining.
Okay. Well, Terry Jackson, executive director of the WNBA's Players Association and former director of law, policy, and governance with the NCAA. Oh, by the way, Terry, I should mention that your son, Jaren Jackson Jr., plays for the Memphis Grizzlies, right?
He does, and fun fact, my husband is a former NBA player too, played 12 years in the league and ended his career with the Spurs. We are a basketball household, I'm proud to say, though I try to keep it separate. My personal life informs my professional life and probably vice versa.
Yeah. Well, Terry Jackson, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Magna, I appreciate it. Kevin, thank you. Good work.
Thank you.
So, Kevin, let me ask you, though, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. I'll bring them in here in just a second. But I do wonder, in listening to what the concerns that Terry was talking about that the Players Association has, I mean, it sounds very much like a labor dispute, right?
Exactly. That's exactly what all of these situations are. They are labor disputes. And it is the idea on the part of athletes that they are, in fact, labor. They're just not players in these sports, that they generate revenue. And they are due an equitable share of those revenues as well as good treatment. And, you know, Terry didn't lay it out, but there's a guy at Forbes who's really been following this and crunching the numbers, David Berry. And he, through his research, he believes that WNBA players are getting about 25% of league revenues as opposed to 50% of league revenues that NBA players get. And obviously NBA players make significantly more money. And I'll also say that WNBA women are not the only women in a pro league who are having to or have decided to fight for a better place within their sport. The women's national hockey team went on strike for better treatment from its federation, and good for NHL players who came out in support of them, and they got a better deal. Mm-hmm. Women's soccer players have had to do the exact same thing, and they too have gotten a better deal because they stood up collectively. So you're starting to see more and more of this, of taking one's agency.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, my hat's off to all of these female athletes who are doing that. But, you know, some of the criticism that they have faced is, well, perhaps their expectations for what they get from the leagues are unrealistic, because if we're talking about labor disputes in a marketplace, mm-hmm. the women's leagues just aren't the revenue generators that the men's leagues are.
They are not, and they understand that. But I think they also feel as if they are due better than what they've gotten. And then you can also look at studies which would suggest to you that also because these leagues aren't marketed and aren't as readily available and advertised over the broadcast platforms that we have, that fewer people tune in to watch and fewer people come out to buy tickets and go to games. So there's also that dynamic at play as well.
Well, let's get a quick call in here. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Rochester, New York. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I had a couple questions or comments, I guess. One being, the physical development of these high schoolers going into this kind of furlough period of training before going into the professional sector. College, I think, gives them that opportunity to physically grow and emotionally grow a little bit before getting into that larger arena. But educational-wise, going into college, if they, enter into the professional level and get injured, now they got to backtrack and go back into college, whereas before they could have gotten a scholarship to play and gotten their education solidified before, putting all their chips on the table for a professional, career. And it's a professional career. As you work your way up the sports pyramid, that percentage of population in that arena gets smaller and smaller. Mm. So at some point, people fall out and eventually have to rely on their education to survive. And if they do this track of, profit sharing and getting more money for being a high school talent, I just think it limits them in the long run.
Right. Well, Mike, thank you for your call. Kevin, you want to respond to Mike?
Sure. That's that's an often heard concern. I think they understand that. But I've always been one to kind of separate the athletics and the academics in this sense, that just because you are pursuing an athletic career doesn't preclude you from at the same time pursuing an academic career. That's what the NCAA has sold us, right? That these are athletes who are being developed athletically as well as intellectually. And we know that for a great deal of them, that really is a fraudulent claim, that's not been happening. That is to say that, just because you're playing your sport doesn't mean you have to discontinue going to school. Mm. Darius Bazley doesn't have to discontinue his education simply because he's putting in so much time and training to become a basketball player. There are more and more former college players who are professional players who didn't finish their degrees for whatever reasons, who are going back now in the NBA and in the NFL and finishing their degree work. And I know some who have gone on to get their master's degrees. So I think that's somewhat of a, I understand the concern, but it's somewhat of a specious argument.
Right. Well, I mean, in Darius Bazley's case, he's foregoing college altogether for now, but
right,
perhaps
now.
Not in the future. All right, Kevin, hang on here for just a second because I want to bring in Robert Keough. He's joining us today from Madison, Wisconsin. He's a writer in residence and program curator at Upper House at the University of Wisconsin. He's editor of the literary magazine The Point. He's also a former Division III soccer player. He played at Wheaton College in Illinois, and he runs his own soccer and athletic training business from youth to professional athletes. Robert Keough, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meghna.
So, the center of gravity of this, any conversation that has to do with athletes and exploitation in terms of the sports business definitely tends to collapse around the NCAA. So I just was wondering what's your response or your thought to this, what Kevin Blackstone is putting out here, that he thinks we're going to be seeing more athletes who are pushing back against what they see as being exploited by, giant leagues or organizations like the NCAA.
Sure. Yeah. And it's great to be on with Kevin. On one level, I think he's probably right. And I think to a large degree, there's nothing wrong with that. For example, the case of Darius Bazley, I have no objection to the idea that a player would pursue another opportunity both for their own financial gain and where Kevin closed, I completely agree with the idea that just because he would pursue a professional career straight out of high school does not mean that forecloses his opportunity on pursuing an education. So there are other avenues to explore this. I think the place that I would be concerned is the ways in which we're analyzing this issue vis-a-vis the narrative of NCAA exploitation.
Right.
And that's something, you know, we can discuss further.
Yeah, so let's pick that up when we come back. We just got to take a quick break here. Robert Keough, stand by for a second, and Kevin Blackstone as well. We're talking about Kevin's thesis here that he put out late last year about, in 2019, will we see a disruptive trend in sports about athletes pushing back against teams, against leagues, against big associations like the NCAA? This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Kevin Blackstone and Robert Keough about this idea of athletes pushing back against what they see as exploitation from major organizations like the NCAA or big sports leagues that they play for. And Robert Keough, pick up your thought that you were beginning with before the break here about wanting to reframe this entire notion of within the NCAA, whether or not athletes are exploited.
Sure. Yeah. And I want to do so by fully agreeing with Kevin's concern that athletes take charge of their life and fully embody their sense of personhood and agency. I mean, I'm all for players getting the best and best deal, the best and best, you know, better and best opportunity for their life. But I think, as was raised earlier in the discussion, there are ways in which this conversation can get muddied when we use words like collusion. I mean, Kevin brought up the possibility of collusion between the college and the NBA with the one-and-done rule. I think the one-and-done rule is a real mess, but it's also a rule that's principally enforced by the NBA Players Association. And so, in effect, what you have is a labor union who would rather not compete against 17-year-old or 18-year-old athletes for a spot on a team. If you're nearing the end of your career and you see the opportunity to make, even if you're at league minimum in the NBA, your salary increases every year. And that's a lot to be looking at losing to somebody who might come in and an organization could say, we can pay them half or considerably less and take a risk on their future. And so I just think it's important to establish some clarity on these things, because where the system in many ways is broken, and various systems are broken, I think, in our athletic and physical culture from youth all the way up to the pros, I think it's really important to establish where and how it's broken, and then not necessarily capitulate to the brokenness, but to find real concrete solutions to the problems.
Well, let me get Kevin Blackstone's response to that. What do you think, Kevin?
No, I agree with that. The collusion that I speak of isn't necessarily the NBA and college officials being together in a dark room over this issue. Robert's absolutely right. The NBA Players Association is protecting its membership behind this rule by keeping out restricting a potentially new labor class. However, colleges also benefit greatly from this and are less likely to fight back because they get this high school superstar talent like Zion Williamson right now, who's the highlight reel for ESPN every day as a freshman at Duke, to promote their product with. So that's the sort of collusion that I'm talking about. This is something that both sides see as good for them. And in the middle, of course, the teenage athletes mm-hmm. get squeezed.
Well, you know, I want to talk for a second about collegiate athletes as well here. So let me just play some tape. This is you're going to hear Shabazz Napier, who now plays for the NBA's Brooklyn Nets. In 2014, he was UConn's point guard, and he told reporters he didn't always have money for food.
I don't see myself as so much of an employee, but when you see a jersey getting sold, it may not have your last name on it, but when you see a jersey getting sold, things like that, you want something in return. And I don't think you know, student athletes should get hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, but like I said, there are hungry nights that I go to bed and I'm starving. So something can change, something should change.
That's Shabazz Napier in 2014. Robert Keogh, respond to what Napier's saying. I mean, I actually found this really surprising that he's a UConn point guard and he's saying some nights, I guess due to financial difficulties, he's going to bed hungry.
Yeah, I mean, as a former college athlete at a much in a much smaller spotlight, so to speak, I guess there were nights where I went to bed hungry too because I was a growing body and you can't eat enough. I mean, I just think we have to evaluate the facts, though. Mm-hmm. You know, at a school like UConn, the basketball team is going to have catered meals before and after games, and oftentimes at their facility, so that they don't have to travel, you know, to a restaurant in town. And if you've been to Stores, Connecticut, you know there aren't too many of those. So on one level, the experience I can resonate with. On another level, I think it's a provocative point that's being made that you know, doesn't necessarily live up to the facts. I mean, I'm sitting in a studio right now that's a stone's throw away from the Kohl Center where the Wisconsin men's and women's basketball team plays, and there's a room in that arena that's just for the athletes to eat. And there's basically a cafeteria in the arena, so they don't have to find a commons area on campus. They can just go right from practice to the cafeteria, eat, and get on to class. And so I want to make it abundantly clear. I think that Napier is talking about something that's real, which is an exploitative system. But I think we need to evaluate and carefully assess where the exploitation is actually happening.
Yeah.
And on what level? I think some of the comments Kevin made just before, I can adopt and subscribe to the problem that he's announcing, but at schools like Duke or, you know, Maryland where he teaches, or Wisconsin here, the question for me is one of institutional integrity. I mean, to what degree have these universities subscribed to you know, a bigger is better narrative in sport that actually has created the problem instead of upholding themselves as institutions of education first and foremost, and weaving athletics into that process?
I think the answer there is a great deal.
Yeah, well, precisely, and in numerous examples, which, you know, Kevin could list off and I could list off, and he listed one of them with Duke just a moment ago.
Well, Kevin, I want to give you a chance to respond to Robert, and then I'm going to bring in some more callers here, but go ahead, Kevin.
Sure. So, yeah, that's not something I would argue with. The Napier thing is interesting, though, just in a historical thing. By the way, he's in his fifth year in the NBA, and he's now earned probably $6-7 million.
Sure. Yeah.
So his pockets are straight now. He can eat.
Yeah.
But you know, UConn was coached famously by Jim Calhoun, and around 2009, 2010, a reporter at a post-game press conference asked Jim Calhoun about the fact that he was making $1.6 million as the highest employee in the state for coaching a basketball team. And Jim Calhoun got very, very angry with that reporter and pointed out the fact that they bring in like $12-15 million in revenues to the school and yada, 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 which just kind of underscores once again that point about equity within the college system. When you talk about basketball and football, which bring in so much revenue, the fact that there could be a player on that team who would complain about being able to buy a meal and a coach on that team who would be able to defend his $1.6 million salary as the largest in the state. And that's something that can be said in just about every state. I mean, we just watched the National College Football Championship, and those two coaches, Nick Saban and Dabo Sweeney, are pulling in $6-7 million a year. In fact, their assistant coaches, the defensive coach for Clemson, over the summer signed an $11.6 million 5-year contract as an assistant coach.
Wow.
So the numbers in terms of the money that everyone but the players are making is just so out of line that's one of the things that has brought pressure to bear on all of this.
Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, if I could just jump in. I totally agree with Kevin, nothing would make me happier than if chancellors of universities would walk down to their athletic department and football and basketball offices and say, when we renegotiate your contract next time, you won't make more than me. I mean, I think as a first step in this process, why have we agreed to this economy? Now, on one level, I would defend the coaches because they're scrutinized on the same basis in many ways that professional coaches would be scrutinized, and their livelihood and salary is going to be contingent on their ability to hold a job. And so even here, what if athletic coaches, instead of being a part of a separate class on campus, were considered in the same light as faculty who have tenure? I mean, you might have a whole different relationship to the athletic enterprise on a university campus if that was established as an ethical and an institutional priority, instead of having a cutthroat model where somebody like Nick Saban is going to go to his chancellor and squeeze the university for more and more money every time there's a chance to renegotiate a contract.
Yeah. Well, let's go to some callers here before I run out of time, okay? So let's go to Bryce, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Bryce, you're on the air.
Hello. I was very recently a NCAA athlete myself. Ran for 4 years at a Division II school. I'd be lying if I said it was terribly exploitative to me. However, I think it's perfectly reasonable and even prudent that athletes to try and protect their future, try and protect their potential career from NCAA exploitation. I think a lot of students go into their college athletic career thinking they have no choice. And I laud the players who kind of take a stand, look around, and see what options they have as far as protecting their career.
Well, Bryce, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Vladimir, who's calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. Vladimir, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. The one thing I have to make is that the argument that a lot of people use is to justify not paying the players is that they're receiving an education. And as Mr. Blackstone said before, that's not necessarily the case. From what I've seen, a lot of these student athletes are forced into, you know, more or less do nothing majors, and they're not really being challenged academically. They're just there more or less to make money for these schools, and that's pretty much the point I have to make.
Well, Vladimir, thank you for your call. Robert Keogh, do you want to respond to what Vladimir is saying?
Yeah, I think Vladimir is sadly right. I mean, that's really the real problem here, and why, if you look at the landscape with a sober view, it's pretty bleak. My suggestion here and elsewhere has simply been that we shouldn't respond to the corruption by accelerating the corruption. or I mean, it would be like saying we live in a violent system, let's drop in more violence. I think it will only increase the problem. So I think he's absolutely right. And this is an opportunity for universities and colleges to take a leadership position and preserve their institutional credibility as higher education arenas where students can gain an education. And if they happen to be elite athletes and want to play sports in that environment, terrific. If they don't and they want to pursue other avenues, including the ones that somebody like Darius Baisley has pursued, they should have every right to do that. And so I think the question is one of what's the solution, and the problems are very evident.
Well, one more call here. Andrew is calling from Spokane, Washington. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for the call. Taking my call. I think the solution to all these problems we're noticing here is the fact of choice. It's important to notice that the only sports and colleges that we talk about with these problems are basketball and football. Baseball, hockey, tennis, these are lucrative sports that make a lot of money, but you don't hear about the athletes complaining as much or being exploited or the scandals because they have the choice of being compensated through a college scholarship, or they can choose to go to the minor league baseball system and get that training while being paid. And it's a long bus ride, they're not as fun as college, but they get money for it. And if we want to solve these problems, we just got to have developed these leagues for basketball and football so that players who want to be paid in education can do that. But they're not forced to.
I
think that's really the only thing we're missing.
Yeah, Andrew, thank you for your call and for that idea. Kevin Blackiston, what do you think?
No, that's a perfect explanation. There is a ton of truth to that. It's interesting that colleges tend to look at those sports differently. But the other point about the difference is that there are two types of sports on a college campus. There are revenue-generating sports, basketball mm-hmm. and football,
right.
And there are expenditure sports, which is everything else. And those two revenue-generating sports pay for the existence of those other sports. And those revenue-generating sports are predominated by black males. Sean Harper, who's now at USC, did a brilliant study that which he updates from time to time when he was at UPenn, which pointed out, just underscored for everyone, that less than 3% of all graduates on major college campuses are black males, yet they make up 50 and 60% of those two revenue-generating sports, which means, back to Vladimir's point, that the primary reason that they're on a college campus in the first place is not to be educated, but to generate revenues via athletics for those universities.
Yeah. You know, we've just got less than a minute to go here, and I know we've focused on the NCAA in this last half of the conversation because obviously it's a huge issue. But Kevin, we started by talking about, the NBA, WNBA. We should have mentioned
right.
the NFL as well. I mean, these are huge
sure.
or powerful, rich organizations. I mean, don't you think that we're going to see pushback from the organizations as well?
Oh, there's no question. Ever since the mid-1880s when John Montgomery Ward, as a baseball player, tried to organize his brethren to fight against ownership and management for better treatment, we've been dealing with this. And the WNBA Players Association is going to be in a fight. We're going to have the NFL agreement expire soon. They're going to be in a fight. Everyone's going to be pushing back because this is a fight over dollars.
Well, Kevin Blackiston, ESPN panelist and professor of sports journalism at the University of Maryland, also writes for The Washington Post as well. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kevin.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Robert Keough, writer in residence and program curator at Upper House, a Christian Studies Center at the University of Wisconsin. He's also editor of the literary magazine The Point, former Division III soccer player at Wheaton College in Illinois as well. Robert Keough, very grateful that you could join us today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.